space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And now, for this week's very special conundrum, how Star Trek has changed the world.
Cam, I can't believe it, but this week marks 50 years since Star Trek first premiered on air with... The one, the only, the man trap.
One of the greatest of episodes.
My favorite. You know, that salt vampire.
It feels like it was just yesterday to me.
Yeah. Actually, it was just a few days ago for me, because I've been going back in anticipation of Star Trek Discovery. I've been going back and rewatching... The man trap again and again.
Have you ever heard of that podcast, Worst Idea Ever?
What?
Where they rewatch Grown Ups 2 every single... Oh, I can't remember if it's day or week. Just on for a full year. Is that what you're doing with The Man Trap to celebrate the 50th? Just watch The Man Trap every single day?
Yeah, but the name of my podcast is The Best Idea Ever.
Obviously.
Yeah. So, I've been watching the original series in chronological order. Because, Cam, you've assigned me a lot of good episodes to watch. And so it's interesting taking it from the beginning. And just, I think I'll have a much better knowledge base when we... begin Discovery,
mm-hmm.
which takes place around the same era, starting in a few months.
Yeah, very true.
So it's 50 years, Cam.
Big event.
I can't believe it, because I haven't watched the original series right now, and it's hard to look back at that and think that was 50 years ago. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I wasn't born or anything, but it just seems so bizarre to me, because it still seems pretty fresh and relevant.
Right. Yeah, it is... kind of astonishing, because you look at so much, you know, entertainment, even from like the 80s or 90s, and you're like, ooh, that's a little embarrassing now.
Yeah. That synthesizer music from the 80s soundtracks, it doesn't quite translate.
John Carpenter, man.
Well, see, I dig the John Carpenter soundtracks, but
too.
I'm thinking like, say, a movie like Cobra, you know, that's a soundtrack that's a little cringeworthy nowadays.
Yes, yes. So. But Star Trek has held up astonishingly well.
Yeah.
So much so that young people get into the franchise through the original series still.
I find that amazing. You know, we heard mm-hmm. from those kids in Las Vegas who are going up to the mics and asking questions at the big convention.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to hear that, yeah, I mean, they're still discovering, you know, the original series. And it's drawing them in. And I don't blame them. It's a fantastic show. And I think maybe... one of the big reasons why is I think the aesthetics are great. And this is why, one of the reasons I'm very much looking forward to Star Trek Discovery, because the aesthetics that Brian Fuller is going to bring to the series, I think he's really going to go back to kind of that very colorful look that we saw back in the day.
I think one of the other great strengths of the original series is that a lot of TV from that era, whether it's, you know, the Westerns, or, you know, like say Bonanza or what have you, a lot of even the 66 Batman show, which I love,
mm-hmm.
a lot of TV of that era is very formulaic.
Yes.
It repeats the exact same pattern every single episode. That is not what the original series did.
It wasn't the same Trek time, the same Trek channel at the end of every episode.
You know, you watch Corbomite Maneuver, and then you watch like Mirror Mirror, and it's two radically different episodes. And then, you know, you jump to like Cat's Paw. Every week, it was like they were making mini movies as opposed to just... hey, we got to make another hour of television.
Yeah, and you look at, well, why don't we kind of go into the cultural influence
mm-hmm.
of Star Trek here and discuss it? Because think about that with other television series that have aired. It's still not super, super prevalent, especially nowadays when you go and look at how serialized television has gotten. But it definitely had an influence on, say, a series like The X-Files, where The X-Files could be a horror show one day, a comedy the next, a caper the next week,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. And that's very much kind of a Star Trek influence that I think had on that particular series. But Cam, what are your thoughts about maybe some of the cultural influences that Star Trek had just over the last 50 years?
I mean, you have to acknowledge Star Wars. Mm-hmm. George Lucas has acknowledged, especially he did it in the actually the Trek Nation documentary that Rod Roddenberry made, that he was very, very cognizant of sort of the strengths of Star Trek when he was making Star Wars. Now, I know fans love to pit the two of them against each other. And so,
as we did on a podcast last December. Yes.
Great podcast.
It was good.
Download it, everyone. But, you know, when you look at the two, they're very different approaches to science fiction, you know, imagery and what have you. But where I think George Lucas got a lot of the inspiration from is how well developed his idea of aliens are. The idea of really creating a universe as opposed to just kind of going with like, because obviously Flash Gordon stuff very much inspired Star Wars, but he was taking from Star Trek the page of, you know, this isn't just like alien of the week silliness. It's like you need to understand this world. There has to be internal logic. All of these things have to be tied together. And I think that just, you know, the idea of such a rich universe is really, really, I think, important to Star Trek and important to Star Wars.
Yeah, I think that's very important, especially, I mean, maybe look at a series like Lost in Space, where it's just the same family doing the same stuff.
Danger. Danger.
Yeah, and it's like, does that feel like an actual universe, mm-hmm. you know, with, as you said, its own internal logic? Not so much.
No.
So I think the influence that Star Trek's exerted on the Star Wars franchise, that's very obvious. And you know, Joss Whedon has acknowledged the influence that Star Trek had, mm-hmm. a space opera, had on the series Firefly as well. Just even think about the ship design, you know, in pulp culture. I mean, prior to that, you'd have...
Rocket ships
were flying saucers.
Yeah, like Star Trek really set the template for having a very original ship, like it, that stood out from any other ship and making it a character unto itself. I mean, flash forward to, you know, the Millennium Falcon, the ship Serenity.
Or even like from the Alien universe, you know, just like they're very distinct looking. And like you said, like a personality in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. That represents what the property itself is. With Star Trek, it's about optimism and sort of this bright look at the future. I mean, that is the Enterprise. You know, the Enterprise is not grungy and ugly. Whereas when you get to like the Nostromo from Alien, it looks... weathered, it looks kind of blue-collar aesthetic, grungy, lived in, very similar to the Alien universe.
Well, let's talk about maybe Star Trek Beyond for just a second, because I think the USS Franklin, I mean, it's a ship that's been crash-landed for 100 years. What do you think about its depiction on the big screen? Because it looks far grungier on the interior and mm-hmm. so much and so forth. Do you think it's that's culled more from, say, the Star Wars / Alien influence that came after Star Trek?
I don't really think so.
Okay.
I don't think it was... I mean, you could say... You know what? I would say, actually, there probably is a little bit of Star Wars, because the big feature of what George Lucas brought to science fiction was the idea of a future domesticated by man. And, I mean, Jayla has domesticated the Franklin.
There you go.
So, yeah, you know what? I correct myself. Yes, okay. I do think that there is a bit of that.
I guess what I'm bringing up is kind of this cycle of influence. You mm-hmm. know, like Star Trek begat Star Wars, which begat Star Trek once again in a certain way.
Babylon 5. Yeah. Farscape.
Lex.
Warehouse 13.
Andromeda.
Cleopatra 2525.
My favorite. But yeah, you know, it's SeaQuest.
Time Tracks.
Okay. Earth, Final Conflict.
I'm running out here.
Stargate, Atlantis.
Oh. Also, there was it Capricorn?
Oh, or Capricorn 1?
Yeah, something like that.
Or no, wait, Capricorn 1 is that 80s movie, isn't it?
Isn't there a TV show? Either way, sense that, you know, all of these sort of science fiction genre shows that, you know... There's another one. That were put to air. There was never a hope with any of these shows that they were going to be the number one show on television. But they knew that, you know, the Star Trek audience was there, so similar audiences could be found. The idea of marketing major television shows to niche audiences really, I mean, owes a lot to Star Trek.
Yeah. maybe let me go back to those aesthetics again, because I think if you just look, and we discussed this in how film has influenced Star Trek as well, but I think, you know, beyond, you know, something like Robinson Crusoe on Mars, if we're talking about color palettes or anything, I think just the influence of those primary colors on the uniforms, just the look of that series, it's so distinctive, you know, and trying to replicate it. Well, I mean, they didn't replicate it in The Next Generation in the series that came afterwards, you know? And so I think it is kind of, I don't know, interesting that they didn't even replicate that in the films, you know, from the original series. What do you think is behind how something that is so distinct and like, iconic, I don't know, do you think that had such a big influence on the rest of the industry after that?
That, to me, strikes me as more of a sign of the times.
Okay.
Because at that point, there was a need to compete with movies from the television industry. And so they went with these bright Technicolor look, you know, to kind of show off color television as it was coming into its own. So shows want to really pop. So you would have Star Trek and the Batman 66 show really trying to essentially show off what the format could do to sell color television. And just as much as, you know when you go to, like, say, like a Best Buy or whatever, and they'll have, like, Inception on the high-def TVs?
Sure.
Same sort of idea. Whereas once television kind of settled into its groove, it became kind of known as, like, lesser than movies. And especially at the time you get Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, etc., showing up on TV, at that point, TV is still kind of a weird kind of ghetto, where, you know, if you're an actor on TV, you're probably not going to go to movies. That's changed since then, so hopefully Discovery benefits from that. But I think that really hurt TNG and Voyager and DS9 in terms of visuals.
And I should say this. I think when we think about television aesthetics, I think it's only kind of the post-Sopranos era of television where they actually were striving to have more cinematic looks.
Yeah.
You know, and so... It didn't help Next Generation that it started, you know, mid to late 80s, when, like, colors in film and television at that time were very muted, drab, you know. So I still love watching the Blu-rays from Next Gen, and those colors pop now that they've been remastered. But, boy, you know, but beyond that, I mean, if we're talking about, like, kind of the cultural influences, I even just kind of like the pop cultural stuff, like... You know, the parodies like Galaxy Quest, or, you know, I like how Red Shirt has entered, you know, just like common lexicon of nerdy things to say. Like,
or just beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah.
Live long and prosper.
Yeah. Resistance is futile, Cam.
Yes.
I'll point it out. This is how I knew, you know, like Red Shirts is actually like a thing. I was watching Lost. This is in 2006. Co-created by one Damon Lindelof, who went on to write Star Trek Into Darkness. Say what you want about that. There's an episode where one of the characters was saying stuff like, I sure hope I don't become one of those red shirts. You know? And like, it's kind of like, you know what the guy means by like what it means to be red shirted.
Even in, you know, Galaxy Quest, Sam Rockwell is making that joke the whole time. And it doesn't have to be explained to the audience exactly what it means.
So I do like that. And I think Star Trek parodies, whether it's SNL or the
Futurama.
Simpsons. Yeah.
One of my favorites, of course, Pigs in Space from The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
I love those.
And I think they're so identifiable. Even if you're not a Star Trek fan, you get what they're doing. And it's so random. Like, I'm not a Family Guy fan, but... I've watched all the clips with, like, the Next Gen crew, like, featured on Family Guy, you know? Like, that sort of stuff, it's so recognizable, so, like, iconic, and it's amazing that, like, this was a show that was considered a failure at the time.
Yeah.
This is not a show that was meant to endure.
No.
It somehow did. Cam, now, do you think that it's almost kind of, like, I don't want to say luck, but like just very good chance that it managed to get just enough episodes for syndication and it started to catch on? And or do you think that there's just something inherently special about Star Trek? Do you think it, like there's another Lost series out there, if only it got another 20 episodes? And I'm not saying it's a sci-fi show or whatever, but maybe something from the 60s, it could have endured the way Star Trek did over 50 years.
I mean, it's tough to say. There's so much lost television. There's so much lost art in general, whether it's film, TV. And you just wait the next 20, 30 years with so many movies getting made nowadays because the availability of technology, of how much art is going to be lost.
Yeah.
And because there's so much churned out, we are not going to have the same video store culture where people are going to be rediscovering things. It's going to be very curious going forward to see how much stuff just disappears.
I think maybe the argument I'll make is go back 50 years. I mean, it was interesting. We were at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas, and one of the actresses from the original series was there, and I had no idea how many fans she had from The Odd Couple, like were complimenting her on her multiple guest appearances on The Odd Couple and a couple other old shows from back in the day. But the thing is, people don't go to Flying Nun conventions. They don't
Wait, they don't?
Well, I know you dress up.
I've been trying to throw one for the last several years.
So what is it about, say, Star Trek, you know, versus just other very popular shows from back in the day?
I think it's the philosophy.
Okay.
Obviously, people love the action. They love the actors. I mean, the characters are huge as well. But I think it's the overall philosophy of Star Trek in that it's simple, but there's a certain sophistication to it that people can really grasp onto and find meaning in.
I don't think it's, you know, just a coincidence that Star Trek premiered at a very tumultuous time in U.S. history. You have civil rights movements going on. You have a very unpopular war happening.
And Star Trek is progressive in that regard because it's showing social progressivism in TV.
Yeah.
Which was way ahead of its time.
And it's surprising how much they were able to get away with that all, like, back in the day. And for a low-rated show... You know, and so I don't think it's a coincidence that this is all happening at the same time. And that's one of the reasons why it endeared. Maybe you think about it from a sociological, you know, perspective. You've got this multinational, multicultural crew all working in unity at a time where it was a very divisive time, not just the United States, but across the globe. We had the Cold War going on, just tons of conflict going around. I do like the vision. And I think it still endures kind of like this united front going forward.
And do you think part of the reason Star Trek still remains such a force is because things are never going that well? You know? So you can always look at Star Trek and go, boy, we're going to get there. Boy, it sure seems bad right now, but we're going to get there.
But and there still has to be something said about like how many flavors of Star Trek you can have. Because look at Deep Space Nine. Because that's still a show where it's just like, yeah, war is pretty... crappy, you know, but somehow Deep Space Nine's popularity only grows. Like every single year we go to a convention, it seems like Deep Space Nine has grown in popularity year after year.
I think that is also differing tastes in what people look for in their entertainment. It used to be people wanted to escape. You go to the Depression era, people wanted a lot of comedies, like screwball comedies became huge during that period. World War II, you know, was much more about heroism and that sort of thing, and a lot of comedies as well, westerns, where, you know, heroes were heroes.
Right.
Nowadays, you look at what's popular, and it's sort of this interesting mix of, yes, things like the Marvel movies do very well, but on the same time, you have The Dark Knight, you have Bourne movies, things that are much darker pop culture looks at the government or the way people deal with, you know, security and safety. So it's a very interesting blend of the two in that people seem to go both ways with their entertainment, whereas that wasn't always as much the case.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating because, you know, people seem to accuse every subsequent Star Trek series to premiere as saying, oh, that's not real Star Trek.
Right.
You know, and but to me, that's what I'm getting at. Like, Star Trek is so much beyond what an individual fan perceives it to be, whether we're looking at the new J.J. Abrams movies, whatever Star Trek Discovery becomes, you know. And I just think it's a very unique franchise. 50 years later, that's just incredible to think. Look, it's never going to match, you know, the popularity of say, Star Wars, but like in terms of box office.
Do you ever want it to?
No.
I don't either.
I don't have that desire, but I mean, think, like, are there... And maybe this is just like a dumb question, but Cam, are there like Star Trek convention or Star Wars conventions the same way that there are Star Trek conventions?
There is the big celebration, it's called, annually, but it doesn't have the offshoots, like where the Star Trek one just pop up in smaller numbers. Celebration is like one big event they hold that, you know, the Lucasfilm itself puts on. So, whereas like Star Trek is sort of, the con scene is kind of more like franchised out and much more fan-oriented.
Right.
So, I mean, that could happen in the future with Star Wars, but they seem to be kind of controlling it more. Same with Disney.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if at a certain point you see, like, Marvel cons.
Okay.
But it's not showing the life that Star Trek cons are. You know what is actually showing the life that Star Trek cons are is Supernatural and shows, like, Once Upon a Time.
And I think with those shows, what they have in common with Star Trek, and also say what they don't have in common, though, is they have like this built-in universe that you had mentioned before that is just very vivid, you know, that people can relate to. They have very iconic looks to them. I think they have like a lot of characters that people really relate to. And here's the key, and I think the big differentiator between Star Trek and Star Wars, as well as these other series, is this philosophical edge to it, where like you can kind of think about it. They're much more thinkers.
Right.
You know, and I think that just...
Once Upon a Time?
No. I mean Star Trek...
Yeah, of course.
Star Trek versus Once Upon a Time.
Right.
Star Trek definitely has the edge there when it comes to being, like, a thinker. And I think that just... It touches people in a certain way. The other thing, you know, if we're going to do Star Trek versus Star Wars, there's just so much more, you know, hours of content for Star Trek. So,
right.
I don't know. It's... There's no comparable franchise to it, is there?
No, because Star Trek has produced so many different series with so many different flavors.
Yeah.
There hasn't been anything like that.
But, like, why hasn't Doctor Who, you know, kind of...
I think...
...grabbed people the same way when maybe you could compare those franchises similarly?
I would not count out Doctor Who. I think Doctor Who, at least on our shores, does not have the benefit of having crossed over... as early as Star Trek did.
Right.
Star Trek was produced in North America.
Yeah.
Whereas Doctor Who has become really popular over the last decade plus. But I don't know that a lot of people here were that obsessed with the 1960s, you know, British versions, or, well, the 1960s version.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, let's throw this out, because back in the day, back in the 90s, they had Hercules and Xena conventions as well.
They still do.
Do you think that's... going to be something going on 50 years from now?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're going to be dressed as Hercules, like...
I am right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Why change?
What was Hercules' sidekick name in...
I don't know. I didn't really watch Hercules. I know the guy, the blonde guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I watched Xena, but I didn't watch Hercules.
Okay. They would be on every once in a while, and I'd catch, like, an episode or two. Mm-hmm. I don't actually remember Carl Urban from Xena and Hercules back in the day. Do you?
No, I really don't remember that much.
I didn't really watch enough episodes to...
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at, look, if you're listening to a Star Trek podcast, no doubt you think Star Trek's special, but I truly believe there's just something very unique about it that has just captured people's imaginations, just struck a chord that no other franchise has, you know, and that makes it, like, a very special thing to me.
And it inspires a certain level of almost obsessive fandom that I really like to see, you know, how it's been picked up by really talented people in Hollywood and filtered into their own work. You know, like Ben Stiller, who we talked about in the Quentin Tarantino episode, you know, named his production company Red Hour Films and manages to work Star Trek references into his movies. Seth MacFarlane, obviously through Family Guy, but also, you know, Ted 2 is a takeoff of Measure of a Man. Say what you will about the movie,
yep,
but, you know, very much an homage. The Purge franchise. That you know, those
really?
Hyper-violent Purge franchise was inspired by Return of the Archons.
Oh, okay.
From the original series.
Well, there you go.
The director, James DeMonaco, has been very open about that. He saw that episode, and that is what inspired the Purge.
Okay. Well, and it's fascinating to think that, you know, even to this day, people are, like, giving the nod of the head to the franchise, you know, they acknowledge it, and it just goes to speak about how many people it's touched, and I don't know, just a very great way.
Do you think it's as cool, even, like, you know how, say, like, Barack Obama has done, like, you know, the Live Long and Prosper, the Vulcan salute?
Yeah.
is that cooler than him just being like, the Force will be with you, or...
I think so.
I think so, too.
And it's more universal. Like, yeah. People know what that means in, like, other countries without having to understand the English language.
But it also feels, like, less obvious. Like, he kind of is in with us. Like, as you know, a geek, you're kind of like, he gets it.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, anyone knows a Star Wars reference, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, whatever. My mom could throw out Star Wars references, and it would mean nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Whenever I see your mom, she's just making Wookiee noises. And I'm like, okay, Mrs. Smith, like, I get it.
Hello, Tyler.
even the fact that, like, are there any other fans where, like, everybody knows what it means to be a Trekkie? What do you call supernatural fans? Do you think the average person knows?
I'm sure there is a term, but I don't. Brown coats is the only one I really know.
Yeah, but for Firefly. You think somebody walking down the street might know what a brown coat is on average?
I don't know, probably not.
I think you ask anybody what a Trekkie is, they're like, oh yeah, it's a fan of Star Trek.
Right.
So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Trekkies aren't the original, should we say into fandom a bit?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, Trekkies aren't the original fans of, you know, like, of sci-fi or what have you. You know, sci-fi conventions have been around since the 30s, but Star Trek conventions, you know, were the first ones that were really focused on one franchise, essentially. Before that, there were more general things. You'd have a mix of comic books and science fiction or whatever. In 1972, the New York Con is held, organized by fans. Gene Roddenberry's there, Majel Barrett, DC Fontana, Isaac Asimov. That really does launch the Star Trek franchise as a convention presence, and really changes the face of what a franchise can do, even off the air.
Yeah, I think part of the thing is that there's just so many fans that were like, oh, I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. You know, this is pre-internet era. People, like, how would you be able to reach out and find other people with these similar interests, mm-hmm. you know? So, and from there, well, okay, so Cam, we're going to Star Trek conventions nowadays, and we're at a time when there's no Star Trek series on TV. There hasn't been one in a decade. And we're also at a time where, like, the internet's very prolific and people can engage with each other online as opposed to going one-on-one to these cons.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, that kind of, it's not the death knell for the con, but, like, do you think that that's really deflated kind of this con experience that had existed for maybe 35, 40 years prior to that?
I think it has a little bit. Like, yeah. I was looking, when I was doing research for this episode, I was doing, just looking at the numbers of Star Trek conventions held annually. And Creation Entertainment does a lot of them. And you look at the numbers they were doing in the 90s, when Star Trek was really at its peak, and they were doing like 150 a year.
Yeah.
They're not doing that many Star Trek conventions a year now.
It's maybe, what, 10?
Yeah.
A year?
Yeah.
So,
in major cities, yeah.
Yeah. Which, I don't know, maybe it's quality over quantity?
Maybe the ones now are more attended than they were then.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't have the numbers.
So look, this convention lifestyle, you and I, we enjoy going to the conventions.
Mm-hmm. I wish there was more of them.
Yeah. The thing that we bring up though, just we're engaging with a lot of people, but you and I noted that, like, it's not as if we'll go meet these people and we just discuss Star Trek philosophy nonstop. We're just kind of having, like, fun with, like, people, like-minded people, you know?
Yeah.
So it's cool to kind of just have those experiences with people that, you know, maybe like Barack Obama, they're in the know,
right?
You know, they kind of, it's our little secret or something. Like,
here's my question to you: go back to that, like, 1972 New York Con, that kind of changed everything. Do you think we're, like, overly kind of nostalgic as like what this con really was? Like, do you think it was the same thing then that they are now, or do you think it was just everyone like basking in the glory of Star Trek?
You know, okay, I don't think there was anything like it back in the day, so yeah. I think it was maybe something special.
Mm-hmm. What about, like, say, the 1976 one? 4 years in, 5 years in?
Well, even by then, like, I do wonder, one of the things that we enjoy doing is going to the vendor's room and checking mm-hmm. out all the stuff that they have in there. I don't know, maybe, like, 6 years or 10 years after the premiere of Star Trek, I don't know how many, like, I don't know, collector's items there were to pick out from the vendor's room.
It would have been a very small vendor's room, I would imagine. Yeah.
Like, maybe a couple tables with books on
T-shirts.
Them.
T-shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I definitely think the conventions, what they are today, are fundamentally different than what they were like 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about the one that we went to most recently in Las Vegas. There was a giant, and when I say giant, I mean giant display. The makeup company,
mm-hmm.
recreated the set of 10 Forward, Voyager's main engineering, and the original Enterprise's transporter room,
mm-hmm.
all in the name of selling makeup. And,
yeah.
like, let fans, like, just, like, putz around in there. And, like, it was great.
And they'd create, like, multimedia experiences, you know, just for the fans to kind of have fun with.
It's all about this sort of engagement, and the fact is...
Engage, you say.
Thank you. But the fact is, like, I don't know, that they weren't having that in 1976.
I
kind of like where we are right now when it comes to the conventions.
Right. So. Well, you look at the original con, you have, like, Isaac Asimov there. I mean, Isaac Asimov, obviously hugely influential science fiction writer. But do you think you would see him at a Star Trek con now, you know, the equivalent of?
You mean Harlan Ellison?
Well, but he actually wrote Star Trek.
Yeah. No, that's a good question, because I'm trying to think about, like, what would be comparable, like, guests that we've seen that aren't necessarily directly tied to Star Trek that have come and appeared.
I don't know that I got anyone.
No, not that I can think of. So, why was Isaac Asimov there? Just, he liked Star Trek?
I guess so.
Okay.
I mean, he was friends with Roddenberry.
Well, do you think it was... still going back to that period, because yeah, there'd be science fiction conventions, but it wasn't only dedicated to a single franchise. Maybe they figured, oh well, let's see if we can draw some other fans in.
It's possible, because Star Trek made its first kind of convention presence at the 1966 Tricon World Science Fiction Convention, and that's kind of how over the next couple years Star Trek would kind of get its name out there and meet the fans that would ultimately save it through letter writing campaigns.
Okay.
Before they would, you know, once it was off the air, you know, by 72, they're holding these cons to kind of bring it back for a revival. But in 66, they're kind of desperate, you know.
Sure.
George Lucas, before Star Wars came out, was going to cons selling t-shirts with the Star Wars logo, just a way of getting the name out there.
Yeah. Oh, we even hear Marina Sirtis. She told us a story maybe last year or the year before about how she was urged just to start going to cons just to save her job,
yeah.
and get the fans behind her.
Right.
So this was an idea back in the day before social media. You need to push yourself, sell yourself at these conventions.
So maybe Roddenberry met Isaac Asimov there, or, you know, was already friends with him, and they would often go to those together. So I'm not really sure, but maybe that's how he wound up at the Star Trek con, the big one in 1972.
Yeah.
But, you know, speaking of what you were just saying, though, about the idea of Marina Sirtis going there and all these, you know, Roddenberry and Majel Barrett going there in the 70s, just before Star Trek goes to the animated series, and keeping the brand alive for so long, this sort of practice, you know, when I remember reading a book about George Lucas talking about it, and he didn't seem that proud of doing it. It was kind of like, he was like, well, it was all I could come up with. Like, no one was supporting this movie.
Yeah.
So I just tried to market it directly to fans. It wasn't something where he was like, this was an honor to do, this was exciting to do. It was kind of like, I was desperate.
Yeah.
Cut to now, and look at, like, San Diego Comic-Con, where, you know, studios are marketing directly to fans through these conventions. So...
Do you think Harrison Ford is happy that he has to go to Comic-Con now?
He did come out in handcuffs for the first one.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I don't think a lot of the actors are, but... This sort of practice that was maybe viewed as maybe embarrassing for creative types to do back then.
Yeah.
They were ahead of their time. They were trailblazing in a way that studios wouldn't follow for like another 30 years.
Well, I also wonder about just maybe it was a bit of a golden parachute for a lot of actors for a while. Like, hey,
oh, yeah.
you get onto a Star Trek series. If you become a convention regular, you know, you're going to do okay for yourself, you know? Because, look, if you look at, like, who's listed at these cons,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot of the same people.
Yeah.
The takeaway there is that I think the organizers know who brings it,
yeah.
and who doesn't. So if you see a lot of those familiar faces, it's generally because they can bring it to a convention.
Right.
So it kind of makes sense that they would cash in on that. I can only imagine what their schedules are like when they're doing, like, 150 conventions a year.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm curious, because in that era... really going up through Enterprise, if you were a genre TV actor, you didn't necessarily have the opportunities afforded to you. Like, a lot of these actors did a Star Trek series, and that was kind of it.
Yeah.
Whereas now with, like, Discovery coming out, and then the actors in the current J.J. movies, J.J. Abrams, Kelvinverse movies, there's so many more opportunities for actors. You know, whether it's all the streaming TV series, there's just endless... If you're an actor with some recognizability, you are going to get work. And so how much of these, you know, how many of these actors in Discovery and any Trek series going forward are going to be in this situation where they have to rely on cons?
Yeah.
It's just, that may be a vanishing idea.
So does that mean that we're going to have to expect fewer, you know, Discovery cast members coming to the conventions in the future, Cam?
I think it might.
Maybe. Okay. That would be disappointing.
Especially with smaller season orders and everything.
Yeah.
They're going to go after talent that's willing to sign on for, you know, 10 episodes a season, 13 episodes a season, which really expands sort of the gets they can get.
But, you know, well, just think in a few weeks, we're going to be at a convention here in Vancouver, Fan Expo.
Mm-hmm.
Gillian Anderson's going to be there. Does Gillian Anderson need to go to these cons to make a living?
No.
So it's to me, it's fantastic that she's willing to do this. I think we can still get some good gets.
I mean, a lot of them do it for charity. So yeah. Hopefully, you know, whatever future Star Trek casts we have, they really want to make charity money.
Rene Abergerona, like from what we understand, he does these cons just for charity now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good on them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can go from the fandom aspect of it to your favorite topic, science.
Yay!
Yay! No, but you know, I just think about all the people at every single convention who may have pursued a career in engineering or science, technology, that sort of stuff. They go up to a lot of the the actors and say, you know, your character really inspired me
mm-hmm.
to pursue this career. And look, we've seen that, you know, come to fruition with a lot of the technologies that are out nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Like the iPad.
Right. Well, the iPad is a little more... I did some research into that. It's more 2001.
Okay.
It's definitely, you know, it's unless we can bring the inventor of the iPad in here and interrogate him... It's kind of...
It's called an iPad.
Yes, it's very true. Like, it is very TNG. I don't know.
Okay.
I think that one's possible.
Let me say this. Like, do you think the invention was just inevitable? And, like, Star Trek...
That's
just...
the fascinating thing to wonder about science fiction in general and its impact on science.
Yeah.
How much is... If you're, like... I mean, most tech people tend to be... A lot of them are interested in genre stuff.
Yeah.
Just personality type. And how much of future technology is based on just being like, hey, I saw this in a movie and it would be cool.
Yeah. Well, even think about, like, say, laptop computers versus what we saw on Picard's, you know, ready room table for a while. You know, so it's kind of interesting to see how things eventually come to form,
Look at communicators and the mobile phone. Martin Cooper, who created the first mobile phone, said he was inspired by Star Trek and the communicators, like, straight up.
Just wearable technologies nowadays. Hey, that communicator on the Next Gen crew, that's a wearable, Cam.
Yeah.
Or think about when we were on the Dominion ships on Deep Space Nine. They're wearing wearables instead of view screens.
Right.
It's like Google Glass.
Yes.
So, and even just...
Also in the future, they work in iPhone stores.
Yes, based on the J.J. Abrams movies. Yeah. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
That's actually one of his go-to motifs. If you ever get around to watching Alias, through the latter seasons, they work in an Apple store as well.
Oh, good, good.
So, there you go.
One of the ones that had never really occurred to me until I kind of looked it up was, and saw it on just online, someone was talking about it, was Bluetooth technology and Uhura from the original series with the earpiece, which had never occurred to me. But again, look how similar it looks.
Yeah. I definitely think just the aesthetics of it were very influential on everything that came after. Do you recall just a few years ago they're having like this contest for like a medical tricorder device that this company was developing this medical tricorder as just part of a contest. They could win like a couple I don't know if it's millions, but it's a sizable amount of money to go and invest in this. But it essentially functioned like this sensor device, much like a tricorder did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So look, people continue to be inspired by this technology, which is fascinating because, I mean, this technology was first introduced 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
50 years ago. And
right.
there are some examples in Star Trek where people are still using, like, binders, which make me, like, you know, scratch my chin a little bit.
But, right.
Hey, what have
you? Well, you know. and you also have, like, 3D printers, which are very much like, you know, sort of reminiscent of, you know, Star Trek.
A replicator?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I buy that. They're making edible 3D printers.
You eat the printer?
Yes, exactly. it's just one use.
One use, and that's it.
But yeah, I don't know. I have no doubt that you know, like we could have like just. I was always jealous as a kid, where like you know, Jake Sisko would go up to Replicator and just order whatever he wanted, and I was just like,
I wish I could do that. You know, one day, Tyler, one day you will.
As look like a 11-year-old, I would have just been ordering pizza nonstop out of that replicator.
Right.
Going, cowabunga, dude.
Right.
So.
FaceTime, too. Just the simple ability of just talking to someone across grand distances on Skype.
Hey, don't diminish the influence of the Jetsons, man. Like,
very true.
Sex robots, Cam.
Yeah, let's talk about sex robots.
Those are going to blow up any day now. We could thank Star Trek.
I don't know that Star Trek would be thrilled that to have inspired the military, but it has in ways. Like, the military has been testing...
Sex robots?
Well, you know, there's a lot of shore leave, you know, a lot of going over, you know, overseas. No, but just some of their applications. Like, the military has been experimenting with transparent aluminum armor. I mean, do you think it's called that if without Star Trek?
With what, the Voyage Home?
Yeah, do you think they're really like, we got to investigate this transparent aluminum?
Or what about cloaking devices?
Yeah, cloaking devices as well as phaser rifles. They've actually created a rifle that looks a lot like a Star Trek rifle.
Okay.
It's laser-based with two wavelengths that it basically is created to temporarily blind enemies. So it's not actually a kill weapon, it's something to blind and startle.
I'm sure there's a really inappropriate joke about Geordi LaForge that you could make there, but okay. Let's think about it this way, though. Look, if you're a big fan of Star Trek and you're, you know, very, very adept at technology, what's cooler than to build technology that, you know, emulates, you know, your favorite franchise there? Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. And just another one I should just mention, GPS. The idea of just coordinating people's spot on the globe.
Is that really from Star Trek, though?
I don't know. Could be.
Okay.
And Universal Translator, Google.
Yeah. That's very... Some of these things, though, Cam, like, I just wonder if they were inevitable.
Maybe they were.
Okay.
But who's to say
who got there first?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's impossible... Unless we bring the people who invented these things into the room... And ask them exactly where the idea came from. It's tough to say. So we're just going to assume it all came from Star Trek because it's the 50th anniversary.
Okay.
And we're just being charitable.
Give them a bow at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, let's go into it beyond this as well. It is 50 years. Mm-hmm. Do you think the rest of the world knows that? How do you think, Paramount and CBS has been responding to the 50-year anniversary, Cam?
Not well. They haven't.
Do you think anybody knows it's the 50th?
It's not
beyond
been,
Star Trek.
It's not
fans?
Been particularly well publicized.
Yeah.
No.
I remember during the 25th and the 30th, there were like television specials going on. Mm-hmm. There were documentaries. It was actually. I remember the 25th being a big deal. In fact.
Yeah.
I'm dating myself, of course, but 50 is a huge anniversary. Beyond some stamps that Canada Post is printing out, I just don't think CBS or Paramount, I don't think their heart's in it right now.
No, like I remember Sony and Eon making a much bigger deal over James Bond's 50th anniversary because they really, really trumpeted the hell out of Skyfall being the 50th anniversary movie. I do not recall Beyond having that much of a hoopla for being the 50th anniversary Star Trek movie.
Didn't you tell me you like saw like some, you know, report that like Paramount thought it was uncool to say Star Trek was turning 50?
Yeah, they thought it would seem old. You know, like what young person wants to see a 50-year-old franchise? I mean, Skyfall did pretty well. Bond, maybe? Yeah. I mean, Skyfall and James Bond, you know, maybe have sort of more of a mainstream friendly appeal.
Yeah, okay.
But nonetheless,
it is inherently cool, right?
I guess.
So.
Yeah, so, but it still whipped up people into a frenzy. Like, you look at the Skyfall grosses versus the Bond films on either side of it, infinitely bigger.
And, well, think about the domestic gross so far of Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, we've talked about the marketing for that film.
Yeah.
I really think that they misfired by not wanting to acknowledge its 50 years. Just what kind of a monumental accomplishment that is to endure for so long.
Because they've done business. I don't even want to say good or bad. It's business.
Yeah,
I suppose.
I don't think there's anything wrong with saying it's the domestic box office was disappointing for them.
Yeah,
but
we're waiting to see the overseas total gross. We're gonna do an episode in the future on sort of the future of that franchise, and we'll kind of go more into depth on that.
I think they have exceeded, like, overseas the grosses for either Into Darkness or 2009.
I don't think they've done either yet.
No,
I've seen it's pretty
have.
Low. I don't think they've even cracked 100 million yet, because it hasn't opened a lot of major territories.
No, they have. I think it's around 150 at this point.
Which is, I mean, Into Darkness was 400 million overseas money.
Are you looking worldwide?
Just total? Worldwide, not taking out the North American.
I think I have to be honest. I think you're mistaken.
I am not. I am 100% sure.
Literally reading a story yesterday about this, and one of the stories had said that they had exceeded the gross. I forget if it was 09 or Into Darkness at that point.
Because I know 09's total worldwide gross, including North America, was 375 million.
Okay, but you're saying. But
it didn't do well overseas. But it did much bigger. It did about 250.
Cam, you just said Into Darkness grossed minus North America 400 million. I don't think Star Trek Into Darkness grossed $600 million.
Maybe you're right, actually.
Yeah. So from.
We're giving just factual incorrect information at this point.
No, you are.
Yes, I am, yes.
I'm fairly certain, like, so far, Beyond has outgrossed worldwide one of the two last films. So, mm-hmm. Again, disappointing numbers, you know, at least domestically, but it's been like that for pretty much like most of the box office film, or most of the box office throughout this past summer. There's been like a lot of hits that have brought in a lot of money, but like surrounding all of that, it's just a lot of bummers around. Like,
yeah.
I think I was reading some stats on that same story. I don't think any movie has, in the domestic box office, has grossed between 200 and 300 million. It's either under 200 million or above 300 million.
Right.
So it's just like either kind of like humdrum results or really, really solid, like explosive results.
Mm-hmm,
so Beyond, it's been on the other side of that at this point.
Yeah. And do you really think they would have lost money hyping the 50th anniversary?
No.
They might have gained it a little bit. I don't know. It's a questionable decision.
Well, I still question this whole Rihanna thing.
I don't.
Okay. I know, I made you buy the single.
Is that the theme for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek?
Sledgehammer?
Yeah.
Yes.
Will that go down? Like, in the future, when, you know, they're celebrating the 75th anniversary, are they going to look back at the 50th, and when they're showing kind of the, you know, the reel of events at the 50th era, they're playing it over Sledgehammer?
I hope so.
Me too.
Because obviously we're going to get some, I mean, it's already my ringtone.
Mm-hmm.
That song's going to endear, man.
Yes,
yeah.
It's true.
So... overall, I think, you know, I really wish CBS and Paramount had put a lot more effort into acknowledging the 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
It's this week. We're doing more than CBS is to acknowledge the anniversary at this point.
It's a real bummer, because when you look at the history of what Star Trek has done, it's so important. Just the fact that, like, you know, NASA named its first space shuttle, the orbiter, Enterprise. Like, that is huge.
Yeah.
That's, you know, Star Wars can't make that claim.
Yeah, I don't think that space shuttle actually went into space.
That's irrelevant. That's irrelevant. But the fact is that, like, it was so important that, you know, it has inspired entire...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, countless NASA professionals. Nichelle Nichols, you see her at a con, she'll tell the story about how she was recruiting minorities and women to work for NASA. I mean, that is a huge deal.
Yes.
You know, I mean, do you think Harrison Ford is out there recruiting people for NASA?
No, he's telling him to get off his effing lawn.
Yeah. I think, you know, not enough can be said about the importance of Star Trek.
No. He's crashing his airplane. saying
into NASA.
Yeah, into NASA.
Yeah, yeah. And walking away from it.
Yeah.
This is totally fine.
It's like, this is why we need qualified people to, you know, in these types of jobs.
He's setting an example of what kind of pilots they should be hiring.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, just the idea of that, you know, not only is the Star Trek inspired people that have changed the world, the cast themselves have been put in positions of inspiring people throughout. And you just don't see that with other franchises. And I think that's so important. And it's almost been undervalued in the last almost like 20 years or whatever, since, you know, the 25th, 35th anniversary. It seems like as Star Trek was kind of off the air and not a lot was going on, yes, you had the Kelvinverse movies, but it doesn't feel like people recognize the importance of Star Trek on the 50th. They may be, you know, championing, hey, the original series was awesome and, you know, Shatner and all this sort of stuff, but it doesn't feel like on this 50th anniversary year, there's been a lot of emphasis on the importance of Star Trek culturally, which is really strange and kind of sad to me.
Well, maybe on that note, like, tell me a little bit about how maybe Star Trek has impacted your own life, Cam, because you actually got into it, like, later on in your life than I did. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's still... Listeners, Cam's literally wearing a Star Trek t-shirt right now. So tell me how it's affected your wardrobe.
I mean, I just have so many more Vedic Braille shirts now.
Yeah.
That's really the biggest thing. It gave me the gift of a Braille. No, I mean, for me, I came to it late in life. You know, I was someone who was big into, you know, comic books and Star Wars and, you know, various things sort of over the years, Dungeons and Dragons for a little while. But, you know, I kind of got into Star Trek just on a whim. The J.J. Abrams movie was coming out, and I thought it would just be fun to watch the original series. I knew it was kind of colorful and fun, and, you know, Shatner's so epic on it.
And you had watched, like, the original series films before that, so you were familiar with it. It wasn't like you're just diving into it cold.
Right, so. Exactly, yeah. And so I just thought it would be fun to do. And I went and bought, quite expensive, actually, the DVD set of season one. They were not cheap DVDs. No, they were not. I think it was like $80 or something. And I just sat down and just started burning through them and ran back and bought season two and three, I remember, the same day, which was like $150 or something, $160.
Remember when, like, X-Files first came out on DVD and they're $120 per season?
Yeah, yeah.
Dear Lord.
Exactly. Anyway. And so it just kind of kept going. And then, you know, I met you and then... And Ben Yong is, next thing I know, I'm burning through DS9. And I just look at the impact it has had on my life over the last 6 years, 7 years. It's been crazy. Like, if you had told me in 2009, as I'm like, yeah, hey, that new Star Trek movie looks fun. Maybe I'll watch the series. Catapult me to the 50th anniversary and we're on stage in Las Vegas talking to an audience of Star Trek fans about the franchise and its impact, you know, just or how movies have impacted Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's just insane, or the fact that this podcast has happened. It's given me so much, like, not just, you know, the fun stuff of the podcast and all that sort of stuff, but just the characters, the huge world to explore that never gets old. Even, you know, I'll watch the original series, I'm just, you know, over again, then I can go and rewatch Deep Space Nine. There's just so much to dig into, such a rich wealth of material, and it's just been, it's always fun, and it's always been exciting.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I started watching it around age 7 or 8, I believe. I think it's just something that's literally like 25 years for you to be just kind of as your number one favorite thing. And I've gone in and out of my interest in Star Trek, though, because there was that long period of time where, I mean, it was on the air nonstop. And I eventually kind of got like sick of it. And I stopped watching Enterprise after season 2. I watched an episode here or there. And I, like, Nemesis wasn't doing it for me. And there's, like, a long dead period where I just wasn't that interested in Star Trek anymore. I still had nostalgia for it. But, I mean, over the last few years, we've gotten these new films, which I've really enjoyed. You and our fallen co-host, Benjamin Yong, convinced me to go pick Enterprise up from season 3 onwards. And I love seasons 3 and 4. I've been inspired to go back and watch the original series from the beginning. It's something that I'm still very much invested in. To a degree that, like, you know, I didn't expect to be, you know, 25 years later when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, watching it, you know? And I think it's because, like I said earlier, it's managed to strike a chord with so many other people in a way that other franchises just, it's not comparable, you mm-hmm. know? So, I don't know. It's something that I've always kind of been interested in space, and I can just get lost in Wikipedia, like, right. looking up, like, you know, space-related things, like how the universe came to be and all that, and I just like how Star Trek kind of sparks a similar sense of wonder in me. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. All I can say is I'm very much looking forward to Star Trek Discovery. My expectations are way too high now, but right. I there's a great quote from Nick Meyer over the weekend where he was just begging people to temper your expectations, because if you go in there with some idea of what you want Star Trek to be in your own mind, mm-hmm. you're going to walk away disappointed no matter how good the series might be. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm going in with just hope, and that's what Star Trek's all about. Is it not, Cam?
It is.
Yeah.
The beauty of Star Trek is, though, that even if Discovery doesn't work, there's still so much great material there that, well, we wait a few more years and then there's something else. Like, it Star
How
Trek
many
doesn't...
more years?
Star Trek never feels like it's going to be gone.
Yeah.
And there's just so much there that's exciting to rediscover and to, you know, there's episodes I rewatch where I'm like, you know, just today I was watching Bread and Circuses from the original series. An episode that I didn't have, like, memories of loving, really, in any way. But I, you know, I just thought it was fine. But rewatching it, I was like, oh my God, this feels like the DNA of this episode is all over Star Trek Beyond. And it just was so much more exciting to rewatch it and just get so, like, something out of it. And I walked away just going like, man, I was really wrong about that episode the first time through. Not just because of the Star Trek Beyond, but just of how much fun that episode is and how creative it is.
Well, the fascinating thing is, like, I watched so many episodes of Star Trek as a kid, and mm-hmm. then there was that period of time where I just didn't really go back and rewatch it that much. But now, for the podcast, I'm going back and rewatching all these episodes and just seeing it through a different prism as an adult and appreciating mm-hmm. all these other things. Or there's episodes I was dismissive of, you know, back in the day, and now I have much more appreciation for it. And I don't know, it's a bit of a gift that keeps giving, I'd right. say. So.
Yeah, and just the fact, like, the community, the Star Trek community, has allowed us to create these friends from across the world who we now see, at least I've seen for 5 summers now, and spent most fun week of my year is hanging out with this group of, you know, similarly crazy individuals that we just have an absolute blast together, and, you know, we all talk online. And we're going to be seeing a bunch of them actually in October.
Is that your Supernatural convention you're talking
well,
about?
Well, actually, Once Upon a Time.
Oh, okay.
You know, gotcha. But, you know how it is. But, you know, just how much Star Trek has given is crazy.
Yeah.
I can't say that any of the other things I've been a fan, as, you know, as huge a fan as I have been, and still am in some cases, have given me as much as the Star Trek.
Well, Cam, let's maybe flash forward 50 years from now. Do you still envision Star Trek being something that's celebrated?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope it never becomes something like Star Wars or Marvel, where they kind of crack the code as to how to make it just mainstream big.
Okay.
I hope it's always a little bit of an underdog.
Sure.
I hope it's more successful than it has been the last few years.
Yeah,
I would agree. Like it if it just found stability. In, for another 50 years of stability is not exactly a reasonable thing to ask for. But I just hope it in 50 years, we find it in a better state in the sense that it's in the discussion. It's something that hasn't kind of vanished for 10 years at a time. You know, kind of just with a few people, but niche group of fans kind of keeping the fire burning. I hope people still recognize the importance of it and that it's still, the franchise itself is still striving to be important. I think that's what it's kind of lost in recent years, and I would like to see that return.
Yeah.
And for Star Trek to be always kind of pushing the boundaries as to what, you know, maybe viewers are even a little bit comfortable with, and being progressive like the original series was, and Deep Space Nine.
And I do think that if Discovery is a success, I think the worst thing that could happen is, like, they're like, okay, let's put 5 Star Trek series all on the air simultaneously.
And that's a good problem to have at this point.
At this point. But I think, yeah. Like, let's Discovery be Discovery maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now. A next series can come along. Mm-hmm. And we still keep pushing Star Trek to new frontiers, so to speak. But I think there is hope that it can still be a like a cultural touchstone 50 years from now, you know, where it's still going to be relevant. Look back 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's like books, plays that are still so influential to this day that I still think, you know, Star Trek can be one of those. You know, it could be, I'm not going to compare it, let's say, Shakespeare, but it could be like an Oscar Wilde sort of mm-hmm. play or something like that. Like something that people can appreciate it, you know, from generation to generation in different ways.
And you just never know when a long-term property can suddenly really explode.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Batman. Batman's been around 75 plus years. Batman has never been bigger, possibly in the history of that character, than now. You know, the Nolan films plus just now, like the fact that it's Batman that's basically fueling this entire godforsaken DC empire.
I know.
I mean,
look, even as bad as Batman v Superman was,
yeah,
that made a lot of money.
It did. Yeah. So just the idea that this character who's been around for 75 years is now so massive. Marvel characters who sat on, you know, showed up in comic books who weren't. Iron Man was not a huge force in pop culture until 2008.
Yeah.
So you just never know when Star Trek could suddenly have its moment.
Well, thank you, Captain Robert Downey Jr. You're going to revive the franchise all on your own.
On the flip side, it could be like the Phantom.
Okay, wow.
But let's...
Sorry, Billy Zane.
Let's hope that's never the case. And I'm choosing to be optimistic, as Star Trek has always been, that I think 50 years, Star Trek will still be a thing. I think... A lot of series we can look at now on TV that are maybe more popular won't be. But I think Star Trek will. I think the Big Bang Theory will be gone.
When you and I are in our 80s, are we going to be at Star Trek conventions still?
That's a good question.
I'd hope so. We'll be in our motorized scooters, you know. But by then, there'll be hover scooters.
You realize we could live to the 100th anniversary.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, like it's
medical
far from impossible.
Technology,
yeah.
You know, we'll get those pills that make us young for
sure.
You know, longer, and
we'll be like a crawl. We'll find people the drain of life.
Yes.
We'll look oddly reptilian, but we'll be there.
We'll forget how to speak English.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. So if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com.
Yes, you can correct both Cam and I on our box office numbers. I'm sure one of us is going to feel very humiliated.
I know I'm wrong. I know I'm wrong right now. Yeah, yeah.
So, and if you'd like to relive that uncomfortable conversation Cam and I had, just push rewind.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go. Coming up next week, we're going to be delving into all the two-parters that we've discussed so far throughout Star Trek.
The Menagerie?
The Menagerie ranks number one among all of the original series two-parters.
Yeah.
But we'll be ranking all the next-gen two-parters. It'll be a fun episode.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it should be. I can't wait to record that one.
Yeah. Thank you, Cam.
You can also reach us on Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Voyage on Star Trek. Voyage on Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTONN, as in another 50 years.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.